Greens pile, which are now 22 or 24 feet high, and they were the first successful transplants. And there were other periods in Holden's history when we attempted fun things like seeing what would grow on the tailings, like Jerusalem artichokes. About the same time, the American Association of Jerusalem Artichoke Growers came out with marketing their little packages of Jerusalem artichokes in the store. They kind of looked like ginger root, only not as appealing. Ginger root, only not as appealing. Okay. Warm it up here a little bit. And of course, on the back side of the package, they had to include recipes because absolutely nobody knew what to do with these dang things. And all the time, Holden had dreams of making millions of dollars for the program here on Jerusalem artichokes. So there have been high times and there have been low times when we've hoped about the remediation and the restoration of the valley. But it's only in the last year when a group of friends that we didn't know from a consulting firm called Dames and Moore began arriving in the village, sponsored by a company called Alumet, which is the successor to the Howe Sound Mining Corporation. We know that corporations are sophisticated entities, and surely Alumet knew when it acquired the assets of Howe Sound that it also acquired some liabilities, but they may not have known specifically about the tailings in Railroad Creek Valley in the North Cascade Mountains of Washington State. But the Dames and Moore folk, environmental scientists of all different kinds, have been here, and we introduced the first cadre of them to the village, I think it was in March or April, by dragging them up the hill in the bombardier in snow that was about 4 feet deep and the consistency of salt. And what I want you to imagine is a treaded vehicle trying to make way through salt 4 feet deep. It doesn't work, and it quickly high centers. And as I recall, it took about 4.5 or 5 hours for us to make it up from the lake, digging our way here. That was their introduction to Holden Village as they began the early spring surveying of the water flows and seeps and other things that they've been studying. Over that time, it's been our pleasure to have anywhere from 12 to 15 of their folks, a variety of Forest Service folks, a variety of other consultants, and a variety of other lawyers wander through Holden Village examining those big piles of stuff out there, and everyone sort of collectively going, But these are scientists, and their task has been, fortunate for us, very concrete. They needed to go out and take measurements. And they've done that, and they did a wonderful job of reporting to us in the spring what they'd found about the measurements of the early thaw and what that meant for the tailings pile. And a few were here in and out through the summer, though not many. And then in the last month, they have returned in order to take measurements in this part of the year, measuring again water flows and this and that associated with the tailings. So they have graciously agreed to give us a report tonight, and it can't be a complete report because, of course, they need to go home and summarize a lot of data before they know precisely what's going on. But they've been kind enough to bring us in on the picture that's beginning to develop about the tailings and about what we might, what might be possible as far as the restoration of the valley, which makes us all very glad. So thanks to Rick and his crew, Don and his crew, all the crew that have been here through the summer, and thanks in advance for tonight's presentation.
Good evening. My name is Don Coberly. I work as part of the Dames and Moore team. As Martin has said, some of us have been here for various portions of the summer. I was here for about 5.5 weeks in the spring. Didn't get a chance to come during the high part of the summer, and have been here for 2.5 or 3 weeks recently. What we'd like to do is sort of summarize the project and For some of you, I realize that there will be much that we will have repeated from the report we gave in the spring. Partly that's because there are new folks here, and partly because of the people I've seen here who were here in the spring, it wasn't really the sharpest guys in the village, so we're going to do some of it over again. There will be two other guys from the team who will sort of lead this talk this evening. Dave Bierkley, here in the blue shirt, and Rick Longendoon. Dave's specialty is in surface water work. Rick is the project manager. He's overseeing the entire project, knows more about the history, and tries to keep us from saying things we shouldn't say. And I've got a list of notes here that I'm sort of trying to go through so you can sort of gauge my talk by how thick this is. The next thing I'd like to go through is just to talk about the agenda as we have planned for this evening. First, we'll do the introduction, which is what's going on right now. Second, Rick will talk mostly about the project history, both the timeline of what has gone on here and the regulatory framework under which we're operating and where we are in that whole process. The third thing is a site description, which I will try to talk about very briefly. Fourth is work done to date and results. We'll all sort of share that, sort of depending on the areas of expertise. Five is what's next, which I couldn't come up with a better title for where the project sort of goes from here. And lastly, questions from the audience. One of the things that Rick will do is introduce the rest of the members of the team who are around so that you can find out who they are. Besides all being really smart and all really good looking, they also are really interested in sharing what it is they know about the project in each of their own areas of expertise. One of the challenges, I think, for us tonight is trying to talk to a bunch of different audiences. There's a great range of experience here and education. I noticed there's one guy here who's a geology professor who knows more about geology than I do. And then there are other people who I can probably snowball a little bit. I've identified the high school kids, the long-term staff, visitors, Elder Hostel, and then Marion Younghans. So there are sort of five relatively distinct groups that we're working towards here. So the point I'm trying to get to here is there's no way that we can talk to all of these audiences at once. And so I've been thinking that we just sort of shoot for the middle, and some people will know what we're talking about and it will seem simplistic, and other people may be a little bit overwhelmed by it. If as we're going through this you have a question, please raise your hand and ask. We're trying to inform everyone who's here about what's going on, and if you're not understanding the terminology we're using or the way we're thinking about it or explaining it, stop us. If it's something we can, Marion. Rick will be here in just a second, and he'll be much nicer to you. If you have a question and we can sort of answer it during the flow of the conversation, we will do that. If we can't, we'll pull you aside later and try and talk things through so that you know what it is, where we're coming from. So. With little further ado, here's Rick Longendoon, who's the project manager for Dames and Moore.
Okay. I'm going to go through real briefly. For those of you that went around the mine site today, it'll be a lot of redundancy what I'm saying right now, but I'd like to get just a little bit of an overview of what's transpired over the last, since about 1896, just to kind of understand what the complexities of the problem is that we're trying to address. Holden came into this valley around 1896 and discovered an ore body. And for those of you that have looked out the windows here looking towards the south, you see these orange piles up on the hillside of an area called Honeymoon Heights. When Holden came in, he actually saw an ore body up further up in the slope. And what he ended up doing is spending the next, the next 20 years trying to develop that ore body and try to determine what the extent of that ore body was. And there were a couple other parties that also tried to develop that ore body as well. Just give it. Can you hear me all right? Yes? If you're looking at the slope, one thing that's really critical to understand is that the ore body, just turn it up. I'm trying to figure out what mechanisms are still causing the problems we have on site. So at that point, we ended up getting into what we call an agreed order, basically an agreement between the U.S. EPA, the Washington State Department of Ecology, and the U.S. Forest Service to have actually a formal agreement with actually a scope of work to bind this into a program to go through not only the characterization or what we call just a study of what is going on the site, to actually then coming up with a list of alternatives to address the problems, and then going through the cleanup process. So with that, about a year ago, we came out and started doing our first sample. And our sampling was really focusing on the primary, as we discussed, the way to summarize this is how is the contamination moving through the system? What do those contaminants affect? And how can we possibly change what mechanisms are occurring? So with that, we ended up coming up with a scope of work, and we ended up doing sampling then of surface water, groundwater, seeps, which Don will explain a little later on, is the reflection of groundwater. Then looking also at the fisheries habitat within the creek, and looking at also the animals that live outside the creek. And with that, actually, I'd like to do is probably move it on to next, to let Don then present then the scope of the work that we've done, and then we'll present the results.
Actually, I want to talk a little bit about the site and sort of the conditions here as we sort of think about them so that you can sort of follow along where we're trying to go. The basic law of water movement is that all surface water and most groundwater flows downhill. So while that makes it bad for Railroad Creek, that makes it easy for our study, because we can think of anything that's up on the sides of the canyons here as where does it wind up? It all goes into Railroad Creek, goes out Railroad Creek into Lake Chelan. So we sort of have this picture, and what we are concerned about is that sort of the drain, what happens to Railroad Creek, and the inputs that come into Railroad Creek, how are those affecting particularly the water chemistry is the thing that I'm most concerned about. Dave will talk a little bit in a minute about the sort of physical aspects of Railroad Creek. But that's the thing that everything gets dumped into sooner or later. What is it that we're concerned about as far as any chemicals or things like that go? If we were talking about the Hanford site, we would be worried about radiation. There is none of that here. If we were talking about a leak at a gas station, we would be worried about gasoline products. We're not worried about that here. The things that we're worried about here, the things that we are studying, are those things that are related to the mining that went on here, and that all goes back to the mineralogy of the ore that was found. When Holden came in and started digging, there isn't this sort of big ball of metallic copper somewhere in the mountain. That's not what happened. He didn't start making wire out of it and send it down the, send it to town on a roll. The materials in which the zinc and copper and iron were found are all combined with sulfide, or combined with sulfur. These are the chemical formula for the primary ore minerals that were found here. And in each case, the iron, the copper, and the zinc were found in combination with sulfur. The problem with that is when these minerals, for each one of them, when you add oxygen and water to them, again, this is a little basic chemistry, O2 oxygen, H2O is water. In the end, what you get generated is the metals in a free state, so this zinc, for example, plus some other stuff, plus in the end you get free hydrogen, which is what causes acidity. So the things that we're most worried about are the acidity caused by this reaction and the free metals into the environment. When these minerals were back inside the mountain, there was very little of this, and, well, very little of this and almost none of that, so this reaction couldn't take place. What has happened because of the mining is that all of these things have been ground up, part of it has been taken away, some of it remains, and now these are free to be mixed with oxygen and water and cause those problems. What's remaining inside the mountain is a bunch of holes called stopes and tunnels and drifts, and therefore there is still some of this material inside the mountain that now has the chance to be acted upon by the oxygen and the water, and that is what then may be transported out through the portal and go into Railroad Creek. So these are the things we're most particularly concerned about: zinc and copper and iron in the water and the acidity that's generated by this reaction. So that's the chemistry that I'm most particularly concerned about in the water. And Dave is going to talk about how what's gone on has had some potential to impact the physical habitat.
Summarized this pretty well. And what he's pointed out is that we're concerned about free metals and the acidity, which the acidity actually is part of allowing those metals to be free. And this material ends up, as Don said, coming down into Railroad Creek in this large concept of a bathtub. And so one of the things we've been doing to look at this is monitoring the flows in Railroad Creek, but also what comes into down off the slopes into Railroad Creek. So we've been monitoring the flows in Copper Creek. We've been monitoring the flows out of the portal. And in fact, I don't know if some of you have seen, today we just put in a weir up at the portal, which is a efficient way to measure flows out of the portal. So what we've been trying to do is track the flow of water, and combined with that, we're also taking water samples, and we can combine actual biometric flow rates of these metals into Railroad Creek. And so what we've done basically is instrument all the different inputs, the pathways by which these minerals that Don talked about can get into Railroad Creek and then thereby affect the habitat, the fish, and the benthic invertebrates, so forth, that live in Railroad Creek. And ultimately, that's our major concern at this point, is the habitat in Railroad Creek and the effects that these minerals have had on the aquatic biota in Railroad Creek. Probably a lot of you are fishermen, and maybe you've fished here before, and you might have noticed that generally you can catch a lot of fish above the mine, but some places right along the mine, there aren't as many fish. And so what we're trying to understand is the exact process by which those impacts to the creek have taken place. Is it food limiting because there's a problem, the chemicals are affecting the food supply to the fish? Is it affecting the fish themselves? Or is it some sort of physical mechanism related to the Spare Creek that Rick brought up, plugging up the stream bed and so forth. So we've been trying to sort all these pieces of this puzzle out and understand what are the important features of this process and this ongoing historical process that is causing the significant impacts in Railroad Creek. And you've probably, those of you who've been around for the last 4 weeks have seen us with all of our mountain of equipment. And so what we've been trying to do is, one of the components of this was to try to estimate actual fish populations in Railroad Creek. So we looked above the mine, and we looked along the mine, we looked downstream of the mine. One of the things we lacked is any historical information in Railroad Creek about the fisheries. So we're trying to compare what we think should be here by looking in other drainages outside of Railroad Creek and hope that this is a fair comparison. So we've spent the last week and a half over in the Stehekin area, and we were looking in Agnes Creek and Bridge Creek and Company Creek over there, trying to estimate fish populations in that area. But we also have been looking at the benthic invertebrates, which are the small bugs, basically, that live in the interstices between the gravel, cobble, and boulders in the stream bed. Those little bugs are the food source for many of the fish. And fish either eat them in their larval state when they're in the water column, or they'll eat them as flying insects. But one way or the other, the insects and the bugs are associated with this water body. And the fish are eating them. The invertebrates, in turn, eat algae, which grow on the rocks. And so the physical mechanisms here of the orange precipitate, which you've all seen, it's an iron precipitate. Don could probably tell you a lot about the chemistry of that. But it's an iron oxide, and it's fallen out of the water column and formed on the stream bed. And you've all seen it. Goes all quite a ways down the valley. And what we're trying to understand is whether or not it's this physical presence on the rocks that may be limiting algal growth, thereby limiting benthic invertebrates, thereby limiting food source to the fish. Is this the process, or is there some other more direct mechanism due to the chemistry? And we haven't sorted it out. This is our task for the winter, but we have the data. We hope we have the data to do that. Studying biological systems is complicated because it's not just the food supply, it's also the habitat conditions, because fish tend not to live in fast water. They like the slower water behind large boulders and so forth, where they can, they're not going to be washed downstream. So the nature of the stream bed, the nature of the channel, also contributes to where the fish are and what their populations are. So another thing that we did, and unfortunately the guy that had this all up left today, so I'm trying to do this as good as I can, but our aquatic biologist left today, but he headed this whole thing up. But he did habitat assessments all the way down Railroad Creek, evaluating the nature of the habitat, the physical habitat, the overhanging vegetation and so forth that all comes into play. And it's our hope that we'll have enough information on the physical habitat, the water quality, the chemistry, the effect of the mine and so forth, that we can put these pieces together and understand what the impacts are. And then once we have that picture, our strategy for the remediation here at the mine hopefully will become a lot more focused and a lot more effective. And I think that's pretty much what I have to say. I'm going to turn it over to Rick.
Sampling events and why we're taking samples throughout the year. This is kind of an ideal. In this bathtub is this creek, and throughout the year, during the winter months, you can imagine that most of the water is kind of bound up in ice and snow, and the flow levels within the creek are relatively low. And if we work, that this would represent kind of the winter months. And then in springtime, within the bathtub, starts rising. And as you get through the months of June and July, you'll get some peaks. And again, this is really idealized, because really what happens is it kind of goes like this. But what we end up doing then, during June and July, then it starts dropping. And then you get into this kind of a flatter curve before you get back into winter. Our objective was to try to capture as much of the data throughout the year. We know that the conditions change through the year as a result of some work that was done by U.S. Geological Survey over the last 3 years. So what we try to do is capture that first event where it comes off the low and then starts rising, which ended up being in April. And we also wanted to capture right before it peaked and right after it peaked, and as it dropped before it got getting down to the winter type levels. So what we have then is four different sampling events. This is the April event, we had a May-June event, one quick event in July, and one then event we have going on now. This event primarily looked at what was available at that time for sampling was Railroad Creek only, since everything else was covered with snow at that period of time. And then this event actually looked at sampling the surface water, the groundwater, the seeps, seeps being our reflection of what is groundwater. Sampling of the fish that they've mentioned. The flows are low enough at that point that could go ahead and sample the fish populations and also the terrestrial wildlife as well. So with that kind of as a background, I guess Dave was kind of mentioning all the risks and everything associated. I guess just to first summarize the overall results is that the risk to human health in the valley appear to be minimal. They appear to be not significant. We've completed risk assessments based on historical data, and that historical data indicates that the risks that were historical from the airborne particulate was pretty minimal anyway, but even now it's been further mitigated. And then we also have the other pathways, the surface water ingestion, for example. The drinking water you have here doesn't come out of Railroad Creek. It comes out of the Copper Creek diversion above the site. And then as far as soil ingestion, most people don't ingest soil, but even at the concentrations of the metals within the tails, based on the risk assessment, there isn't a significant risk to any human health. And obviously, we're not walking around with big spacesuits on either. I mean, we're walking around with normal gear. And what we found is that the risks are really minimal. However, the problem is, as Dave mentioned, is that the fish and the insects that are in the creek are a lot more sensitive to those metals than humans are. So as a result of that, what we're trying to study is what are the impacts of the zinc and the copper and the iron on fish. So that's kind of the focus of what our work has been trying to gear towards is what is happening. What is happening from upstream to downstream. What's happening within the tailings piles and such. So in April we sampled the what we found is that if you look at this is Railroad Creek. If you look at the water coming out of the portal drainage though, the portal drainage actually comes out of this of the low a little bit sooner than Railroad Creek. And as a result of that, since it has relatively high zinc and copper and aluminum, and this is still at a low, you have an initial influx of copper and zinc into Railroad Creek before the actual before the flows start rising in Railroad Creek. And that was first brought up as a hypothesis by the USGS, and that was confirmed by what we found, is that there's like a couple week window where the concentrations of metals in Railroad Creek are higher in a relative sense until these concentrations starts to increase. We also found that the portal drainage starts falling off. When we go out there right now, even though we've had all this rainfall, we don't see a real increase in the portal. But what we found though is really interesting is that we've all been assuming all along that the tailings were really a major contributor to all the impact within Railroad Creek. What we found is when we look at the percentage of what we call the load of the metals in Railroad Creek, in the creek now during this period of time, we find that the major contributor is actually that portal. The water coming out of the portal is a significant contributor of metals. And we look at the data in May, and the beginning of May, we found that the portal actually contributes to around 70% of your overall loading of copper and zinc in Railroad Creek during that period of time, and it starts falling off. That's a really important issue, because when we look at the rest of the site, we thought the mill would have a major contribution. As it turned out, the mill had around 2-5%, and the tailings are running around 13%. And so it kind of really changed our mindset of how we're looking at this whole problem. Is we realize what we need to still do, we need to somehow affect this water coming out of the portal that's really early on in the season. And that's kind of a real broad brush of a conclusion that we ended up drawing from this work to date. The reason why we came out here now is to confirm that the concentrations of metals decreased, and we won't know that for sure until we get the results back in about a month. But based on the USGS data, they show that during this event, the copper and zinc is actually far lower than it is during this event here and here. excuse me, I'm sorry. It's cold, really getting to my chest. So with that in mind, we've really been trying to focus on how to answer the question then of what do we do then with that load. I'd like to just go real briefly on, I think you wanted to show how the samples are collected in the groundwater wells, and
I'll talk about that all of the other.
Okay. Like all the work that we've been doing. Okay. In conjunction with that, then we also had we were sampling soils. We wanted to confirm what the concentrations of metals were within the tailings piles. We also want to look at the other outlying areas. We want to look at the mill and see whether there's any adverse or any potential environmental impact there. So we have some material has been brought to us being potentially asbestos-containing materials. We think it's wood fiber materials, but the agencies were concerned about that. So we sampled that suspect asbestos-containing material. We also have an area up near Winston. Does everybody know where Winston is? Winston, there were about 103 houses, and one of the things that came up as a potential concern is that there were few oil tanks associated with each one of those houses, and we didn't know what the status was of those tanks. We knew there was a couple of tanks in the village that leaked a couple of years ago, and the concern we had was that there may be some leakage of the tanks up in Winston as well. So we've gone up and actually explored that area to see whether there's any leaks. We also looked at the mine itself. Our original intent was to see what is, you know, since Don was mentioning that we have this process of these sulfides that are back in the mine, none of us have actually been in the mine. There's around 57 miles of underground mine workings, plus, as I think Ed gives a good little discussion when he goes down on the bus on the way out, there's some stopes, these big openings I was discussing earlier, some of them are as much as 700 feet high and 200 foot across, that are still open at this point. The ones below the 1500 level that I mentioned to you, most of those have been backfilled with tailings materials. But the ones above have not been backfilled, and we don't know what happens with the water from the surface through the ore body and coming out the mine. Our intent was to actually go into the mine. What we found is that we consulted with some mining engineers. They thought we were pretty crazy to consider going into that mine at this point in time. So we haven't been able to do that, so we've had to focus on a step approach of how we're going to get into the mine over the next 2 years and assess that a little bit further. Oh, animals, yeah. And the other thing we want to look at is looking at risk then. We want to also look at the terrestrial wildlife. We have, as you well know, a lot of wildlife exists around in the valley, and we want to know what wildlife exists, and then when we collect this data looking at concentrations, we go through what we call a risk assessment, try to see what the impacts would be to the wildlife within the area. And Dave mentioned the fish habitat, but you're also looking at deer and all other terrestrial wildlife that exists within the Railroad Creek Valley. So with that, I'll pass it back to Don, who's going to discuss this real briefly about the sampling method.
One of the concepts that Rick started to talk about was this idea of loads.
and it's something that we talked about fairly extensively in the meeting in the spring. And it's sort of a framework way that we look at the problem. And the conceptual, or sort of the picture that I have in my mind, is if Railroad Creek is running along and poorer quality water is getting into it, what we're concerned about is that metals load, the amount of zinc that's coming into Railroad Creek. Let's picture that by taking the portal, for example, and over a certain amount of time, putting all of that portal water into a big pot, and then boiling the water off and seeing how much zinc is left behind. And that's the zinc load that comes from the portal. And this is a way that we can compare how much zinc comes from the portal as how much comes off the tailings piles, as how much comes from maybe the other side of the valley. So that's the sort of key piece of information that I was directed to investigate as far as groundwater went, because everybody blames all the surface water problems on groundwater. The two things that make up load are the discharge. How much water there is, and what the concentration of whatever the metal of interest is in that. Does everybody see how that those two things come together? That you could have a lot of water coming into Railroad Creek, but if it's clean water, there is no load. You could have water that's got quite a lot of zinc in it, but if there isn't much of it coming in, the load will also be small as well. So everything that we have tried to do as far as any water evaluation goes has been to try and find both those pieces of information. Railroad Creek, first thing we need to know is how fast, how much water is coming down Railroad Creek. And Pete and Steve have spent a lot of their time this summer measuring the discharge in Railroad Creek at various places to see how much water comes down the creek. How do we measure what flows into Railroad Creek? One of the things that Rick talked about were these seeps. A seep is simply an area where water that has been flowing underneath the ground daylights and comes to the ground surface. There are 26 or 27 of these areas that have been identified around the site, primarily through work that the USGS, that's the US Geological Survey, that they have done over the last 3 years. When we were here in the spring, we went with the fellow who had headed up all of that work and went around with him and made sure that we saw the same places that he saw, and he sort of looked at our sampling work to make sure that we were doing things appropriately. And those seeps run anywhere from a number of gallons per minute to, in some cases, a number of drops per minute. So there's, if you walk across the pedestrian, the bridge there with the top on it, and look to the downstream side, you'll see a piece of PVC sticking out of the bank. And that's, in fact, one of the seeps that had been identified by Jim Kilburn with the USGS. And if you want to look at it for a while, you can see every now and again another drop of water will come out of that pipe. That is a seep. It doesn't flow very much. Therefore, the load isn't very great. That's one of the things that Rick, that we came to from our evaluation of the early data. On the other hand, the portal, the reason that the portal has such a large load is because it flows quite a lot of water. You can see that it's a creek right now that's a couple of feet across and a little bit deep, and it runs pretty fast. So all that dumps into Railroad Creek generates a fairly large load. That's the stuff that comes from the seeps. The stuff that the other source would be from groundwater. What is sort of the diffuse flow of groundwater that comes off the tailings piles and gets into the creek that way? The things that affect groundwater flow are the difference in elevation, how much driving head there is, and the how easily the material transmits water. So we have done studies on that to figure out how permeable the formation is. We did some of that in the spring by using what's called a slug test, which is just a way to find out how fast water goes out of a well into the surrounding formation. We have some work going on currently as far as permeability into the top of the tailings piles to see how easily water is transmitted into the tailings pile and then can be pushed through. So those are the things that we use to measure discharge, how much water there is. The way that we measure concentration is for a seep, we put it in a bottle and we send it to the lab. And the lab does an analysis on it and tells us how much zinc is in the seep. Those things flow at the surface so that we can catch them in a bucket and we can measure how much time it takes to get 5 gallons in a bucket and we have a discharge rate. To find concentrations from a well, and if you walk along the tailings piles, there are 60 or 70 wells up there. Those are the stove pipes that those are protective casings. Inside each of those is a well, which is a 2-inch piece of PVC tubing that has been drilled down anywhere from 30 to 120 feet, and water from the surrounding formation comes into the well. And one of the ways to sample that, one thing we can do is we can run a pump down the well and pump the water out. Another piece of equipment that we can use is called a baler, and this is our one prop of medium. Tie a rope around this end, run it down the well. As it goes down the well, it goes through the water column. There is a check valve in the bottom that once this fills up with water, the check valve gets weight on it and you pull it back out and you dump it in a bucket, and that's the way we sample a groundwater well. And those of you who are thinking about a career in environmental work, you'll spend a lot of time running one of these. I had a note here. That's what we did. The reason that we are concerned about this load, and Rick may have mentioned this, is that it helps us to focus our attention and our efforts and our clients' money on those things that will provide the greatest benefit to Railroad Creek. If that seep that I talked about that's flowing a few drops a minute out of the tubing, to spend a lot of money to try and clean up those 5 or 6 or 7 drops a minute doesn't make a lot of sense to our client when for the same amount of money they can be fixing the portal drainage and decreasing the load in Railroad Creek and hopefully making it better for the fish. So that's the reason that we have taken this approach, is to make efficient use of the resources that we've been given. So that's what we did. What did we find based on the May sampling? Rick covered that fairly well. The idea that the portal drainage is something that puts a large load into Railroad Creek. As well, those seepage from the Honeymoon Heights area is also more, shows more of an impact on Railroad Creek than anyone has thought of previously. Before it was, up until May of this year, it was essentially an afterthought. It was, we don't know what's going on up there, but it can't be much. We've got these big bloody tailings piles down here that must be shucking a whole load into the creek. Well, as it turns out, that's not really the case. So through the work that we have done this summer, we have sort of reconsidered our conceptual model and said, maybe the tailings piles aren't as bad for the creek as we think they are, and maybe we need to expand our thinking as to where the load comes from, especially from those seeps a little further upstream. So that is relatively new news. We didn't know that 6 months ago. And that's something that we will have to take into account as we go through this process again of what studies do we need to do next. So that covers the groundwater and all of the other programs that Rick had talked about. Again, thinking everything dumps into Railroad Creek, that leaves it to Dave to talk about the impacts on the surface water and the aquatic biota. So.
And he mentioned that Pete and Steve have been measuring flows in Railroad Creek, you know, all summer long. But that's not the only thing they do. They also read staff gauges, And we also have a continuously recording staff gauge. What a staff gauge is that measures a relative height of water or a depth of water. So every time they measure flow, they read the staff gauge and they can develop a graph where we have flow on one axis and the gauge height or height of water on the other axis. And I just put a marker floor. And they get a curve like this. And so what this allows us to do is during periods when they're not measuring flow, we can read the staff gauge only and estimate flow, and then we can reconstruct the flow history of the creek for the entire summer, which we in fact have done. They just installed a system like this at the portal behind a weir, so we'll be able to reconstruct flows out of the portal now on a continuous basis as long as we have our recorder going up there. So this will just give us a much more detailed record of the flow conditions in the creek. And then that ties in, we tie that in with the seep flows that Don talked about, and we've estimated groundwater, we'll estimate the influx of groundwater, and then we can reconstruct the whole loading history to Railroad Creek based on what we know of the seep, the flows of the seeps, of groundwater, of the portal, and we put it into the creek, and then we can do this historical loading. And just as Rick pointed out, there are periods of time when loading and is high flow and the creek is low, and that's your sensitive period. This is when the creek is the most sensitive to the water quality issues that are coming from the mine. And as Rick said, that primary period as we know it right now is the spring. You'd think there's tons of water around. Why is the spring the problem? Well, the problem is because melt happens here before it happens up valley. And so the peak of the river is happening much later than the peak is happening right here locally. And that's the reason. Yes, there is. Yeah, and I will say this, based on what we've seen so far, there's very little actual physical erosion of the tailings problem. The significant erosion problem was windborne. That was but the gravel that's been put on top has done quite a job in reducing that windborne problem. Waterborne erosion of the tailings doesn't seem to be a real large problem, but there may be some other. We're starting to discover, our brand new geologist, Steve Wilbur, who came on and started looking at some of these small other issues that may be related to that, which we'll be looking at in more detail. And in other words, there may be some other erosion mechanisms that we weren't aware of that are bringing iron into the creek. But anyway, that will all hopefully congeal this winter when we bring all this together. With respect to the habitat in the creek, we've been measuring the actual numbers of benthic invertebrates. We've measured the population of fish with two methods. We've done a snorkel survey, which is Bob and Mike Rick would just get in the water and they with their snorkels and they count fish. They see them and they count them. And they crawl up the stream bed counting fish. And we, I don't know, some of you have saw that and it's pretty funny to see, but the other way we're using to check that, and we're using these two methods so that we have a lot more confidence in our results. And it was also, we wanted to make sure that we did have that confidence, so that's why we're using the two methods. But the other method is actual electroshocking of the fish. So we get in there, we with electrodes that create a current field around the electrode, fish goes into this, fish muscles contract, it turns, comes to the surface, we net it, and then it comes out, and we haven't, I don't think we've lost the fish yet, have we? Oh, maybe. But anyway, they generally, they're not supposed to die with this, and they do recover, and we hold them till they recover, then we measure their weight, their length, and we identify what species they are, and we put them back. And so what we've, with the two methods, we've been able to establish some population counts, and by that, knowing that information, we can tie all this physical data and this chemical data to the actual effects that the populations and so forth in the tree. And I'll turn it back to Rick.
Our job over the next 3 or 4 months is to try to consolidate and analyze all this data we've compiled. And our job is to get a report out in the middle of March that summarizes all the data that's been collected over the last year. And also to compare that data with all the data that's been collected historically as well, and see what trends we can see over time. With that then, at that point, we will also then be developing what we call remedial options or alternatives to come up with options to try to address the problems that we've addressed or we've developed or characterized over the last year. And as far as the options go, the options are actually quite open. The only option right now, the agencies have pretty much agreed not to to allow analysis is they actually take all the tailings materials, transport them down lake, and take them down to an off-site landfill. But other than that, everything else needs to be considered. And that ranges from reprocessing the tails to as little as maybe just continuing with the revegetation of the tails, and also with options to try to segregate out the clean water from the dirty water on the site. The real easy way to look at it, I guess, is that right now we have that water come out of the portal, and most likely what will be one of the major options will be addressed is the idea of actually running that through a treatment type cells before it actually goes in a river creek. If that's the primary source, we can reduce the amount of metals loading significantly. We'll also look at diverting all those seeps that Don mentioned. We'll analyze the results, the positive results of collecting all the seeps and running them potentially into wetlands areas. And some obvious places that this architect I mentioned in the 1975 ORB identified, they actually looked at a couple of areas where they could set up some wetlands areas, and we seem to concur that I think there's some good options there. One is a wetland up between the footbridge and the vehicle bridge. The other one is actually down near the Copper Creek where it runs into Railroad Creek. One of the things the ORB had brought up that we think is an option is to actually divert Railroad Creek further north from where it is now through an old drainage channel that used to be in that area to try to keep the water away from the tailings piles as much as possible and try to keep to develop a small wetlands in that area to treat the waters coming out of the seeps. Another area that could potentially be analyzed for treatment is east of the tailings pile number 3. And try to enhance the wetlands that exist in that area now. And again, it's really conceptual, but our job is to try to look at those alternatives and see what benefit we get and what the impacts are. And at that point, after the different alternatives have been analyzed, then we involve the entire public, including Holden Village, into the process, and they help us as well as the agencies to select an alternative that we end up then incorporating over the next two to five years. It's a very open consensus process. It's not something that's done behind closed doors. What the regulation does do, though, under CERCLA, is that it allows us to go through the data collection process and go through the FS before we actually include the public. What we found historically, if we include the public too early before we actually can draw any conclusions, we end up spinning our wheels a lot and not getting a lot of work done. So we find it's easier to get all the agencies involved, they are overlooking the work, and then from that point of view, we develop the alternatives, and then the public gets involved, and they can review all the data we've collected to date, and then help us to select the best alternative to address the problems that we've identified.
I think I've addressed that. The Forest Service, by the way, is the lead agency on this project. And I think the Forest Service has already been in contact with the village to get their preliminary input, and they will continue to get input from the village and from the general public. There was a fact sheet that was distributed about a month ago, and that fact sheet kind of outlined everything we talked about tonight, and then it will move forward through the public involvement process over the next two years. The overall objective is to try to get these remedial alternatives developed by 1998, and then go through the analysis and the public involvement by 1999.